Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Equity markets shrug off the coronavirus concerns, but fixed income markets tell a different story. The January employment number is out, and it's really good. A couple of great listener questions and a look behind the scenes of what is driving the markets. All this and much more on episode number 648 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello and welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast for the week ending February 9th, 2020. I'm your host, Andrew Horowitz. Thank you so much for joining me once again on this weekly gig that we do where we talk about the financial markets and investments and your financial prosperity and security for the future. And of course, just to mention, we also have DH Unplugged, where myself and John C. Dvorak get together each and every week on Tuesday evenings for a live stream, and of course, record it and have it available on every podcast directory that you know of that you can find out there. DH Unplugged, a really fun show. That is a really fun show. If you haven't had the opportunity to listen yet, I really encourage you to do so because we go off the beaten path in that show talking about things related and somewhat unrelated to the financial markets. Well, over the weekend, I know you like to hear these stories because you tell me this, and I thought I'd just bring this one to you. I did some fishing over the weekend. I went on a friend's boat and I got up really early on Saturday morning, 5 a.m., got everything ready, got some rods ready, some snacks, some drinks, had a plan going, got to his house, left the dock at about 6:30 a.m., was out in the ocean at about, I guess, about 7:15 in the morning. And we were looking for some fish because we had a full moon that thought, hey, maybe there was some good news there. The cold front was coming a couple of days later. That's usually good for fishing. The wind was blowing, kind of a windy day, a bit chilly. Seemed that conditions were ripe for fishing. Well, you know where I'm going with this, right? And they say that the fish bite better, especially in the winter in Florida when the seas are a bit sloppy. And that's what we got. We got this washing machine, start out a little bit slow and then built throughout the day. But, you know, there was no fish. And fishing has really been tough, especially in Fort Lauderdale. I would say over the better part of the last couple of years in the wintertime. And I'm not really sure what's going on. But it really, I mean, there really has been a significant change in the amount of fish that's caught over the last, I would say, 2 years. And we've tried everything. We've tried different depths, different styles of fishing. We did kite fishing. We put a kite out with baits dangling in the water horizontally out and vertically down. So you have this kind of really, we have electric rods that put out this kite. We do deep dropping. We use different baits and speed jigging and speeds and jigs and live bait and cut bait, they call it. And we use artificial bait. Well, on Saturday, we pretty much threw everything we had at it. We trolled for a while, should have been good wahoo fishing in the morning, right in the right depths where they usually should be. Nothing, not a fish, not a whisper of a fish, not even a thought of a fish. We saw a couple of things surrounding our baits just for a moment. That was it. And you know, it's not just us, not just me, because we read the fishing blogs, fishing reports. If you're a fisherman, you do that. And some are saying that the area is overfished. There's a lot of pressure on it. Some saying it's because of the bad water management in the area. Maybe the artificial reefs that were put down incorrectly. A lot of these rubber tires were put out there, and that kind of screwed up a lot of stuff, especially because they move around and they wreck the rest of the reefs. because they tie them all together. And with heavy storms and tides, and when the wind's blowing hard and you got these big waves, even down deep, it starts to create a motion on the floor and it moves these reefs. And as they move, these artificial reefs, they sometimes collide with the natural reefs and wreck them. So, I don't know. You don't want to hear all about my fishing stories because we have a lot more to talk about, but maybe you know about it. I don't know. Maybe it's going to change. I've seen this before in other areas around the country, and what ends up happening is over time, good news is it corrects itself. We're hoping it is. I'm not even going to bring up climate issues. That could be an issue that you do see on the boards as well, but okay. Well, let's shift to some good news and let's talk about economics because there was some really good news last week. We had the manufacturing number that was sub 50 in contraction zone for, I guess, the better part of 7 months come up and breach the 50 level, which is the demarcation point between contraction and expansion or growth, if you will. And the manufacturing number really did pretty well. Over 50, that's a good sign. The services number, 55, another good sign. You combine them together, you give a 70-30 weighting for manufacturing to services, and you have somewhere in about the 53.5 range, which is good because we are seeing a consistent level above 50 when we look at that. And when we look at the U.S. economy, we know that we are in a general growth mode. Yeah, we're going to see about a 2% growth rate at best probably this year, considering the GM plant issues, the Boeing issues, the coronavirus issues. But we're still going to see growth here in the United States, and that's good news. And what we're also seeing is that on the heels of that and on optimism about the economy moving forward, even considering all the things that we have outstanding that are concerning factors, that non-farm payrolls grew by 225,000 in January, which was better than the 158,000 level that was being predicted. It also confirms the other employment numbers that we saw out not only earlier in the week, but throughout the month. And it tells us that U.S. hiring activity is maintaining its strength. Average hourly earnings increased by about 0.3%. That was expected, but still, we're seeing that growing. Unemployment, well, it did tick up a little bit up to the 3.6 level. Nothing to be concerned about, whether it's 3.4, 3.5, 3.6, in the range, you know, of a tenth of a percent, either direction really doesn't have too much of an impact, obviously, until we see a trend really move significantly in another direction. But right now, 3.5, 3.6, fine. Those are good numbers. So we're seeing a really good sounding from companies in that they are willing to hire. They're willing to risk putting on new people to work because they think that the outlook is pretty strong. The biggest boost for payrolls came from the construction sector. About 44,000 jobs were added there, while the worst hit was manufacturing. So there must be a lag going on in the manufacturing sector because there was actually a net loss in the manufacturing sector. But other than that, we saw that retail companies, generally speaking, and technology and healthcare put on some employees. So, but again, the totality of the report was really fine. So overall, this is a bright spot and probably one of the most important indicators of the U.S. economy right now. We look elsewhere around the world, of course, we are seeing a slowdown, a shutdown, an absolute stoppage of economic activity in some parts of Asia, particularly in China and the central part of China, as well as how it is impacting other areas. I heard a great story on, I think it was BBC this week, that talked about how in Australia, there are different levels and different qualities of lobsters, and they are very much sought after in China. And they save these very high-end lobsters for the Chinese market. They get the most money for it. And what is happening is the lobster fishermen now are going out, going to their nets, and finding those particular lobsters and throwing them back in the water because there's essentially a slowdown or a complete stop of exports of these lobsters to China as the coronavirus and as the containment of this is going on, where people are not spending, they're not going out, they're scared for their lives, and areas are in lockdown anyway. And when areas are in lockdown, you're not just going out. I mean, I've heard other stories from people that have seen real time, live, with their own eyes, the lack of activity. I have a friend who is stuck in China right now, can't come home. Streets in some areas are empty. Look at Macau. There's another two-week closure of the casinos there. So the intra-movement of people and businesses and the economy inside of China is pretty much at a stall. Essentials, of course, are being taken care of. But people are not traveling. They're not going out. They're not eating. They're not buying. And we have a great clip coming up that talks about some of this with Muhammad Al-Aryan that I heard this weekend on the Barron's Roundtable on Fox. And I just think it was probably one of the best encapsulations and the best summary of what's going on from markets related to the coronavirus, but also how markets are reacting to this. And we'll get to that because I think it's really interesting. But before we get to that, I want to mention that I had some really interesting calls with clients and people that want to become clients this week. And I look at that oftentimes as trying to follow along on how the discussion changes over time. And it does. And we went from a concern at the end of last year about, you know, markets being a little bit high, but yet I want to get in and, you know, be opportunistic and be diversified. And clients, especially prospective clients that were coming on board, we were onboarding them for one or several of the strategies that we manage. And there was a very similar tone to these conversations. And these conversations were all about, you know, I really want to be involved, but yet I don't want to get slammed right off the bat. I'm willing to put money to work, but I want to do it slower than normal. I think that, well, you know, things are good and generally I'm excited about getting involved and being involved or staying involved in the markets for the long term, but the short term, you know, something doesn't feel right. That was kind of the tone back then. And then it subsided a little bit. Now the tone has become a focus, a pretty big focus on questions about the market's behavior, especially in the light of the headlines that we're seeing recently on, you know, how there is a slowing down and how the earnings have not really kept up and how we've seen a multiple expansion. And people are nervous. People are nervous. They think right now that there is going to be a really big payment in the form of a market correction and wondering when it's going to happen. And maybe, I'm sure you have been thinking about this too. The question of when is this going to happen already? I mean, why aren't markets more sensitive to some of the things that are going on? And most don't really understand why money keeps on flowing back into stocks and see that as a warning sign. At the same time, there are a lot of people who have come to us and said, you know, we want to buy opportunistically. We want to buy when there is maybe a market dip. Well, take that and expand it out. Think about all the people that are looking at the markets and thinking that they want to get involved, but yet they want to buy when the market does come down a little bit. The question then becomes, how much down is enough to where you're going to put money to work? Is your number 2%, 3%? Is it a stock that's down 10%, 20%? And if you think about that, again, expand that out, that you're not the only one, or these people I'm talking to are not the only ones thinking about this, that maybe people are concerned that they want to get in before it starts going back, so they kind of push their numbers a little bit higher. So if they had a 5% correction level that there was there, that, okay, you know, if markets come down 5%, yeah, I'm going to get in. Well, if everybody starts doing that, maybe some people are thinking, well, you know, I've seen this story before. Markets really only have to come down 3 and 3.5, 4%. So they step in front of it and they get it going and they start investing in the market earlier than what their particular target may have been. And this goes on to a point where you can hardly have a downstroke in markets before people are actually going and investing again. And we really can't argue with a lot of the concerns because we have the same concerns. I have the same concerns. Because if you look at 2019 and the whole argument about how markets expanded so tremendously and why they did so through a multiple expansion, which means that stocks essentially were moving up because people were willing to pay more money for the same earnings they got the year before, maybe on the hopes that, yes, earnings will get better in the future. Maybe the recent period right now is just a stall, and that stall of earnings is going to be temporary, and it's really going to kick up later because we have a lot of good things that are happening on the baseline of the economic story, and because there is some really good tax benefits available for companies. Regulation is down. You know, name all the things that we know about. But people are willing to pay a lot more for earnings that we have. And this is in a time where growth of earnings and revenues have essentially stalled. But people said, you know what? I still want to buy that stock. And the other thing, of course, that people had a lot of concern about in the conversation I had was this whole coronavirus and the impact on not only the concern about, okay, you know, am I at risk of getting this? And people were like, well, I'm not going on a cruise. Think about the cruise lines. Think about the potential for cancellations. Because who wants to be cooped up with 3,000 of your unclosest best friends on a ship where the potential for what is happening now, a quarantine for days or even weeks, or a ship that's out there right now that cannot find a port because no one will let them land or dock up because there is a case or two or several potential infections of this virus on the cruise ship, and nobody wants to deal with that. A particular cruise line is being turned away from, I think, three of four. I think the Philippines, Guam, I think Japan has said, you know what? We're not interested in you landing here. So the cruise lines are really probably going to take a pretty big hit here because cancellations and then the discounting, the refunds, and the lack of sailing that's going on right now, the slowdown in the industry because of this particular condition. Now, they're going to have to do some pretty fancy footwork and PR to get people over the hump of being concerned about this. I'd be concerned, and I'm pretty easygoing when it comes to this stuff. But you know, even I wore a mask on my recent trip to D.C. Both ways, on the airplane, I put a mask on. You say, Andrew, oh, come on. Are you nuts? Is that crazy? Are you going a little bit outside the boundaries here? In fact, we're seeing that several doctors are saying that masks won't even help unless you wear them properly. Did I wear my mask properly? I have no idea. It had a nice filter in there. It was rated very high for the mesh. I don't know. Maybe not. But I was careful. I washed my hands quite regularly when I got on the plane, when I got off the plane. I didn't touch anybody. Maybe I touched the armrest, I don't know, maybe but I kept to myself. I was very aware, very concerned, and this is what's happening with other people. I'm not the only one doing this. I'm not the only crazy lunatic that is trying to take extra precautions in this area, and this is going to be a big problem for travel. On top of the fact that we have a travel shutdown to begin with, where planes from major countries around the world, the airlines are not flying in or into or out of China. In particular, in one of the greatest travel times in a year for China, where you have the lunar holiday and the new year, where people go and travel not only intra-country, but outside of. So on Sunday, we saw that more than 37,000 cases were confirmed and have been reported on mainland China. 800 deaths. We are now above the deaths of the SARS virus. Quarantines are everywhere. Somehow, for some reason, we're hearing word that China doesn't want the help of anybody out there. And you got to wonder with some of the things that they're doing there, if it's really a lot worse than they're talking about. Essentially, this whole quarantine problem and the shutdown and lockdown of many of the cities are causing a major shutdown in production of companies. And now outside of China, several companies are starting to warn, especially those in the high-end retail area. Some are expecting major hits to their sales of 30, 40, 50, even 60% over the next couple of months. And we don't even know how long this is going to play out for. Already we're starting to see reports that the escalation and growth in infection rates have slowed. The death rate has not slowed. And they're doing a lot of comparisons to markets and SARS. When SARS hit back in the early 2000s, China was not as much of an integral part of the global economy. So all these correlations they're trying to draw from this is a bunch of hooey. Let's say that. I mean, really, it's total crap. And if we think that this is over, even when it's over, I have a bridge to sell for you. I have a piece of land in the swamps of Florida to sell to you. Because this is not over. The fact this is a very serious situation because the way this has been constructed and the way that this has been, whether you want to say that it was slow or it's been aggressive by China, depending on how you want to look at it. They were slow in the beginning, then they got very aggressive because they missed the boat. This is going to impact the global economy. And again, by some measures, 0.5%, depending on how long this is going to be, I think 0.5% is a very reasonable number if it all stops right now. But the global supply chain is going to get hit. And if nothing else, there's going to be a very significant slowdown in travel, in production within China. Now, that also gives us some benefit for other areas. You know, people that maybe had, you know, think about this. Let's say that you had this desire. You're like, hey, you know what? You know what I'm doing this summer? I'm taking a trip to China. Now, that was, let's say, in November, October last year. You're starting your trip to China. It's this summer. And now here we are today, February, coronavirus. What are you doing? You're thinking, maybe it's gonna skip out. It's done. I'll have a good time. No problem. Or you're saying, maybe on to be on the safe side here. What I'm going to do is I'm going to plan a trip to, I don't know, pick your poison, South Africa. Or I'm staying in the United States. I'm not even going outside the United States. I'm going to take a trip to, I've never seen Mount Rushmore. I've never seen the Grand Canyon. I've never been to Vegas. But are you going to continue planning that cruise? Do you want to take that risk? Probably not. So there's going to be some places that are going to probably benefit in terms of travel, in terms of summertime. And I would venture to say that the problem, though, is going to be the continuation of this slowdown in China moving forward. But we'll see how this plays out. But there's a lot more than just the news headline on this. I want to go through this interview with Mohammed El-Erian. He was on the Barron's Roundtable this weekend on Fox. And I want to take some of his discussion and explore some of this because it talked about the specific areas we're discussing today. And I think he did it in a really good way that clarified it to a point and made it very much easily to be understood. So let's listen in on what he had to say, what he was asked about, what impact the coronavirus could have on markets.
So first, it depends which market. If you're talking about the equity market, it doesn't care. It is striking how quickly we've come back and reached new highs while the coronavirus uncertainty is still considerable. But if you look at the bond market or if you look at the commodities market, they care. They haven't come back to levels that we saw before the outbreak. So it's all about liquidity ultimately.
And this is what I liked about what he said because he got right to it. Liquidity. Liquidity is what's driving markets right now. And he didn't beat around the bush and talk about, you know, all the fundamentals and all that, but he talked about what we've been talking about for a long time is this whole central bank ability to try to provide a put and try to provide confidence and be flushing money into the markets.
Liquidity, ultimately, liquidity continues to disconnect the equity markets, not just from other markets, but also from fundamentals.
When asked about the market's never-ending ability to just discount everything and have no concern for this whole coronavirus thing, he was asked, well, why is this happening? And why does this seem to be so outlandish that, well, you know, market's just going to pop back at every occasion?
Yeah, as absurd as that sounds, and there's a couple of reasons for that. One is most of the shocks we've had recently have proven containable, temporary, and reversible. So think about the attack that took out half of Saudi Arabia's oil production in September. Think about the attack on killing an Iranian general. There was a lot of concerns, but the markets treated them as temporary and reversible, and that was right. Secondly, markets have been conditioned to trust central banks. And when you trust central banks...
And here's, once again, the meat of it, right? That central banks are a big part of this whole liquidity push, and buying the dip seems to be, you know, really what people are looking to do because they believe that there's a safety net. But anyway, let's continue on what he said.
And when you trust central banks, you buy on every dip. You get this FOMO effect, fear of missing out. So whenever you see a sell-off, it's a buying opportunity. And I think these things are so deeply conditioned in the markets that we have disconnected quite a bit from fundamentals.
Yeah, so separating from fundamentals, right? So exactly what we've been talking about, the whole idea of a multiple expansion where the fundamentals of equities are not really as important as just buying equities. So let's kind of listen in now as he is asked about Europe, and in particular about the ECB's ability to keep Europe out of a recession that seems imminent, and the impact of negative interest rates and Europe's economy overall.
So first of all, the numbers haven't gotten better. This week, we got a horrible industrial output number out of Germany, a 2.1% contraction, the biggest in the last decade. And in addition, the forward-looking indicators, orders, are also pretty bad. So Germany will be in recession. Germany is the locomotive of Europe. It is now turned into the caboose of Europe. So I do worry. I think we're going to hit stall speed in Germany, which is sub 1%. And when you hit stall speed economically, the risk of recession is high. Can the ECB do anything about it? It can sure try, but it won't. They're starting with negative interest rates. Their monetary policy is not only like pushing on a string, but there's concerns that it's becoming counterproductive. Negative interest rates eat away at the dynamism of a market-based economy, and I think people in Europe are increasingly worried about that.
I got to be honest, I love that. Negative interest rates eat away at the dynamism of an economy. It's pretty much counterproductive. One of the best quotes, I think, from this whole discussion that he had here, but he's a lot of other things in here that I just thought was great nuggets. Let's continue on. Listen.
Interest rates eat away at the dynamism of a market-based economy, and I think people in Europe are increasingly worried about that. So the ECB may try to do something, but it will not fundamentally change the economic outlook. You need a much more comprehensive policy response.
So now he's going to get into a discussion about the potential for a thawing of, or maybe even not a thawing, but a change in the dynamic of the trade war, and how we have a little bit of a pause that's going on with the escalation with China, but what's the outlook he was asked about?
So it's a good thing we've had the truce, but I wouldn't bet that it's going to be followed by phase two. I think more likely is that we're going to see tensions escalate again.
Now the host goes back and he starts questioning again about why markets aren't impacted by any of the stuff that's going on. You know, while we saw that move last week or the week before last, and then a rebound this week, and big week of news on the political front, and we have the debates, and we have various impeachments, non-impeachments, all this. Why are markets just not reacting to any of this?
Yeah, it isn't. And there's a good reason and less good reason. The good reason is the argument it's too early. So you don't want to position for something that can still play out and is uncertain. The second reason, which is not so good, is that the market is so obsessed with liquidity.
There it is again. The same thing. Liquidity. I mean, I think he's making a point here.
Obsessed with liquidity that it doesn't care about anything else, be it politics, geopolitics, or economics. And I think the coronavirus is a really good example of that because its economic effects resemble what's called a sudden stop.
Now, this is what we've been talking about. The problem that you have with a just turning the engine of an economy off just cold and how it plays out.
That you bring to a halt economic activity. It starts with the areas that are most impacted and then starts spreading. And look at what we've heard from one company after another. Burberry saying that their sales are down 75%. That is quite a sudden stop. Even Fiat saying that it may close one of its factories in Europe because of the supply chain disruptions. The airlines have canceled trips. Visitors have come to a halt. So be careful of these sudden stop dynamics. It's not easy to restart an economy.
So that has some really important implications with regard to how the economy is going to play out in terms of the world economy, the supply chains, and all the backups that we're going to see. So I think he put that pretty well. And then he was finally asked about, where in the world is a good place to invest if we have all these problems? We have these issues in Europe. We have these issues in China and Japan and the supply chain issues, and we have the coronavirus. Well, that's not much of a surprise, but it was what he had to say.
So first, let me tell you, economically, there is one bright spot, and that's the U.S. The employment report this week again confirms that we are in a good place. Not only did we create 225,000 jobs, not only are wages going up faster, but we attracted back into the labor force. Both labor force participation and the employment to population ratio went up. That's good news. So the U.S. economy is doing well. U.S. assets relative to the rest of the world are still more attractive. But I've made a relative statement. The absolute level of asset prices, of risk asset prices, be it stocks or be it corporate bonds, remains elevated.
And I think that was in the closing remarks that he made right there, the end of the interview, how he talked about the relative discussion of valuations and attractiveness of the U.S. economy and of U.S. stocks. Kind of the cleanest shirt in a dirty closet, that concept, where things are looking really good here, but it's also on a relative basis comparing to others and to the other economies and the other issues that are outstanding out there. So I thought I'd bring that to you. I enjoyed it. I thought it was a really good and a spot-on discussion about what was going on around the world, how markets were interpreting it, and just a little bit more of clarity on this whole issue that answered a lot of the questions that people were asking me throughout the week that we went through, but also from another source, a kind of a backup to some of the things we've been talking about. If you have any questions, of course, you can send them into me at any time over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. There's a little button there, very easy button to click. It says, Ask Andrew, and just put in your question, and I'll be happy to get back to you on that. And of course, if you want to check out, and do me a favor, because it's been, I think, an interesting time when we're seeing a lot more concern about portfolios for clients that are prospectively coming in. In other words, people looking at their portfolios and saying, you know what, maybe it's time that I have somebody professionally look at what's going on. Should I be holding all these securities? Should I have more securities? Should I have less equity? Should I have more bonds? Should I have more international? And they're coming to us. And I got to tell you, it's a very interesting thing to see because we could really measure the angst in the markets when new people are starting to send us their portfolios for review. So if you want us to review your portfolio, see if you are style diversified, see if you are properly set up, and give you some advice on that, just go over to the Ask Andrew and pop me a little note right there too. I'll be happy to give you an answer on that. We had a couple of questions come in also, and let's see here. One was more of a statement. James B. writes in, he says, Hey, Andrew, I enjoy the show and also DHM Plug. Thanks for your hard work and insights. You're welcome. I said you're welcome. He said the thank you. I'm sure that I'm not the first to make the following observation, but I've not heard anyone else make it. I'd be fascinated to know what you think. According to Donald Trump, the U.S. is enjoying the greatest economy in U.S. history. The economy is forecasting to grow by 2%, and that's this year, and the U.S. deficit is about, well, $1 trillion. Now, $1 trillion is about 5% of GDP. So the government has borrowed, printed, and spent 5% of GDP in 2020 to grow the economy by 2%. It seems to me that claiming to grow on borrowed money makes us much more sense as claiming to get rich by taking out bank loans. That's pretty funny. Yeah, I got a bank loan for $1 million. Now I'm a millionaire, right? Thank you so much. It's Pient. Let me put a few things in there about mobile numbers. Okay. Yeah, I think that it's a good point that you mentioned there. And I think a lot of companies are trying to buy themselves out of an economic downturn by increasing their debt. And you have to look at both. Listen, when you look at a company and you look at a balance sheet, Balance is the word in the balance sheet. There's assets and there's liabilities. There's owner's equity. But really what we're doing is balancing the assets and the liabilities in the balance sheet. It's not just what do I have as assets, as you say, and very astutely, I think, about how, yeah, if you just take a loan out, it makes you look rich. Well, you have to then take that loan. And if I have $1 million loan, I put on the balance sheet as an asset because I put it in my cash account. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to have to put it into my short-term or long-term liability account. And that crosses out. And that my net worth is now, well, zero. You can't say that, well, now I'm going to take $1 million loan from the bank, put it in my asset sheet, and pay myself $100,000 a year, and that's my income. It doesn't work like that. So I think that's a very good observation by you, James, on this matter. And I think that when we look at the way that countries are indebting themselves and trying to get themselves out of a problematic time period to boost the entire economy, it's again, nothing more than a confidence game. The hope is that they will stabilize and keep the confidence in not only in markets, but in people, allowing them to go out and spend. I was out to dinner on Saturday evening. And on Saturday evening, there was a restaurant that I haven't been into for a while. Well, the maitre d' comes over. We start talking a little bit. And he said to me, you know, it's interesting. We have been busy straight up, straight on since November. And it hasn't stopped. Usually about this time of year, it kind of slows down a little bit here. And I said, well, what's going on? He says, I don't know. But it looks to me, this is what he said. It looks to me that people are willing to spend again. Interesting comment. People are willing to spend again. And I thought about that. And yeah, that's what we're seeing with consumer confidence high and the stock market is reaching all-time highs and people are feeling good about their jobs. And generally speaking, there's a high level of confidence. That high level of confidence translates its way all the way through the economic cycle, all the way through the stock market, all the way through all the numbers that we see on a consistent basis, the ability and desire and wantingness to spend translates itself down the entire chain into the purchase, the manufacturing, the production, the jobs. And that is what they are trying to maintain at all costs. And I think that's reasonable to do so, but you have to wonder when they're going to allow for the forest to catch fire and clean out some of the underbrush that's built up. Because if you continue on just focusing in on the market primarily as your benchmark of effectiveness of an economy, because I think central banks have gotten very twisted and very scared after what happened in 2008, 2009, that they've in a way lost their way. Their mandates are, yes, for price stability, which translates into markets. Their mandate is for inflation, which is obviously something they can't seem to get going. Their mandate is for jobs and job security and job expansion and obviously economic stability. But they've taken their job to mean that at all costs, they can use some of the mechanisms as excuses to continue on with the very bad policy decisions. Anyway, James, that was a great question. And I think what you're saying is spot on to what's going on right now. Do I have an answer? No, because I'm not in charge of the Fed. I'm not in charge of central banks. I'm not in charge of the policymakers. They're not going to change. They want to stay in office in their position. And it's just going to continue on until somebody comes along. And maybe, as crazy as it sounds, it's going to be a flushing out of the markets if somebody maybe in the next 4 years, the 4 years after that, has a much different view at the top of the you know U.S. equity, U.S. Government, and doesn't look at the markets as a benchmark of success. But we'll see. Hopefully not. We don't want markets to go down. Obviously, that's not the point. Point is that, you know, there needs to be a cleansing, though. Steve writes in, Steve B. He writes in and he says, I've been listening to you for several years. Great show. I can't recall you using the term price discovery until your last show. This was back in, or a couple of shows ago. I guess that was in right in the end of December. If I'm wrong, I apologize. If I'm right, would you please explain it more fully in an upcoming show, please? Great question. Price discovery is the whole idea of, okay, how do we understand what the true value of an instrument is, whether it's, I don't know, let's say it's a fixed income, it's a possible commodity, it's an equity. Primarily, we look at equities and markets for this. What we want to know is, what is the value of that company per share? Is it valued properly? And you go through the valuation process. You can use a dividend discount model. You can use a earnings discount model. You can use a whole bunch of maybe quantitative screens and filters. You can use simple ratios. Whatever you use as, because it doesn't really matter. Whatever the analyst uses as their way of valuing the company is what they hold their entire life on whether or not that stock is properly valued, undervalued, or overvalued. Okay, so simple, right? We can value this. Now, the problem is that what we're seeing, though, right now is a warping, a bastardization of that pricing model. Because when you have people that are willing to buy stocks at any price, you can't have what's called price discovery, the ability to understand and discover the price of what should be that underlying instrument. Because people are willing to buy it at any price, regardless of the fundamentals, the pricing discovery process, because buying the dip is constant. And when we take into consideration valuations that are based on not only the underlying fundamentals of a company, but also the outside influencing factors such as the economic backdrop or political stability or instability or the value of the currency. One of the other things is the valuation of interest rates. Where are interest rates? And as so low as they are, it's just warping the entire dynamic. Therefore, price discovery is very difficult. Where a stock drops because earnings are no good, but yet picks up the next day for no reason whatsoever, the discovery of price is eradicated. The only thing that matters is that people have money and they're buying. ETFs have also changed the dynamic when it comes to price discovery. So there's a lot of things that are going on in the markets that are really causing a hampering of this process. Will it ever come back? It comes back from time to time. It's not only in flushes of the market, but it comes back. Right now, value and energy stocks are seeing price discovery play out pretty well and possibly to a level that is maybe overdone to the downside. We'll have to see what happens with energy and energy prices that are pricing in a pretty big slowdown for China and the world. But right now we're seeing copper have price discovery. It's not just being lifted because there is a central bank put behind it. Oil is seeing price discovery. Gold. There's a variety of things that are actually working properly, but not the stock markets right now. So that's price discovery. Again, ask any questions that you want going over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and just clicking on the Ask Andrew page. We're going to end it for this week right here. We were supposed to have a guest this week, but she was traveling. We have a great couple of guests lined up, especially a guest that I really want to have for a while in the commodity space. I'm not going to let the cat out of the bag till we totally confirm it, but I think it's going to be the following week. Not next week, but the following week. So we have some great things coming up. Please subscribe, leave your reviews on iTunes, and ask any questions that you want. And I will be available on Tuesday in the chat room with DH Unplugged. And I'm going to see you again next week on The Disciplined Investor for another new, fresh episode. Thanks for joining me. I'll see you again next week. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.